This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The World Cup in Qatar this year was preceded by years and years of controversy, charges of shameless corruption and mistreatment of migrant workers. But then the games finally began. Staff writer Sam Knight reported for us on the tournament.
The first 10 days of the World Cup in Qatar was soccer as it is, rather than as you want it to be. It was venal, closed, and transactional. I saw some terrific goals. I drank Coke and paid with my Visa card. I lined up for the Adidas store. Everything was brand new, air-conditioned, and covered in an almost invisible layer of pale desert dust.
Sam just got back from Qatar, and he shared some of his impressions from on the ground and in the stands.
This was my first World Cup.
Yeah.
Grown up with the tournament, watching it on TV, but this was the first time I'd ever traveled to see it in person. There was something about this particular edition in Qatar which was just irresistible to try and explore. You know, the whole world was in Qatar, because you did feel like you had kind of, you were shifted somewhere else on the world's axis, and the center of this tournament was the Middle East and the Arab-speaking world. And you'd go to the, you know, the souk in Doha.
There'd be the call to prayer as you kind of walked to a game or as you came out.
It rang to Moroccan fans and Tunisian fans and Saudi fans and Qatari fans. Literally a billion or more people in a different way, and in a way that made it feel like their own. This was a very tame and well-behaved and moderate sporting event. I went to Argentina, Saudi Arabia, which was one of the kind of most exciting early matches in the tournament, and there were thousands of Argentinian fans, and there were tens of thousands of Saudi fans. If you're a reporter at one of these things, you have your own desk. So you sit at your desk, and then like during the game, you like write down at your little table like what's happening. But then at halftime, I'd go out and like mingle in the stadium concourse and wander up to people and have conversations with them. So one of the people that I spent a bit of time with was a young Qatari guy called Ali. It was fascinating chatting to Ali about his parents' feelings before the family went to the opening game. You know, this fear that maybe some soccer fans would come to the World Cup and they just wouldn't leave afterwards.
The Qataris, to varying degrees, were terrified of the influx. Families installed security cameras and checked their window locks. In the days before the World Cup, social media filled with prayers and stoic messages for the test ahead.
And so the idea of, you know, a million soccer fans descending from all corners of the world was kind of terrifying to people who kind of like things to be extremely orderly and organized. I'm a football fan, you know, I'm English. I grew up in London. In English stadiums, it's an immediate kind of sense memory overload of cigarette smoke and fried food and alcohol and unbearable language and a kind of, you know, a tinge of danger. That was different in Qatar. It was safer, it was more polite, it was, you know, it was very welcoming in lots of ways. I also had a really good chat on Zoom one day with a young Qatari woman called Asma. And she was a mad soccer fan. She was a big Real Madrid fan. She was saying, I want to get out into Doha and like capture the atmosphere, but you know what? There's so many games on TV. I'm just tied to my TV at the moment. She was just absolutely absorbed in it.
All but condemned Germany to a second straight group stage exit. And it comes to Morata! Spain get the breakthrough!
And she'd followed the reporting and the build-up to the tournament, you know, in great detail, and felt kind of honestly confused by how Qatar didn't seem to be able to do anything right.
The fact that Dubai, a popular destination for European soccer players and their clubs, didn't seem to attract the same kind of ethical scrutiny drove her crazy. They go to Dubai and they love Dubai, Asma said. They don't care about migrant workers there. They love to take pictures of Burj Khalifa, the world's tallest building, but they don't care about the people who build Burj Khalifa. It just gets, like, very confusing from an Arab perspective. Very, very, very confusing.
I think for Qatari people, you know, they literally watched this evolving storyline of how awful they were. And it started with them being, you know, the corrupt people who paid for the World Cup. And then it moved on to the way that migrant workers were treated. And they just felt like, to use a soccer expression, like the goalposts were shifting every time.
It is the frankness of the Qatari system, more than its iniquity, that is unusual. This is a common and almost universal kind of setup. That's what Natasha Iskander, a migration scholar at New York University, told me. She said, and this is one of the reasons that we're all implicated in the system. It's not, you know, the Qataris behaving badly. It is us, as a global community, really having to confront what it looks like when you rely utterly on a system that deprives people of rights beyond their economic function.
I think having been to this World Cup will make me experience the sport a bit differently now. Just to have been shifted on my axis a bit. It's to see a sport that you've kind of known and followed through your whole life from a particular angle, really knowing and seeing these games play out in a very different place is something really meaningful. And it kind of, it's happened now, so it can happen again.
Sam Knight's full story at Qatar's World Cup, where politics and pleasure collide, is at NewYorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, for Washington insiders and people in the media especially, Politico publishes some of the scoopiest and wonkiest reporting inside the Beltway. It's not what you'd call a mass market publication, but it's a highly influential one, and it's had some very big moments. It was Politico, after all, that obtained Samuel Alito's draft opinion from the Supreme Court about the decision that ended Roe v. Wade. Last year, the German news publisher Axel Springer bought Politico for a pretty startling sum, $1 billion. Springer is based in Berlin and owns the German tabloid Bild, among other properties. And it's led by CEO Matthias Döpfner. Döpfner is famously contrarian, and he likes to chide American media for pandering, he says, to increasingly partisan audiences, even as he himself seems to relish taking provocative stances on some very significant issues. I talked with Matthias Döpfner recently.
So a very basic question to begin. The media business, as you know better than anybody, is a very tough business these days. Why did you spend $1 billion to buy Politico?
So for two main reasons. In general, I believe that journalism has a very bright future if we get some things right. And to complain about digitization as a threat to journalism, I think is just wrong. I think digital journalism is going to be better than analog journalism ever was, because there's so many more opportunities to have access to information, to the intelligence of the users, to have no deadlines, to have unlimited space, to have a lot of new aesthetic opportunities. And also the business model is potentially better. So there are a lot of reasons for optimism. The most important thing is, do we really focus on relevance and on integrity and trustworthiness of journalism? Or do we trap into that into do we fall into that trap to polarize and just, in a way, amplify prejudice of our readers, which I think is not a sustainable model in the long run. And having said that, I have already, in a way, indicated the second reason. It is all about the quality of the content, about the kind of unpredictability and open-mindedness and nonpartisan approach of journalism. We have this kind of contrarian bet: if everybody polarizes, the few who do differently may have the better future. And I think Politico as a brand stands for that.
You and I, we, and everybody else in our business has been to 1,000 conferences and conversations with where we discuss partisanship and nonpartisanship and objectivity and all those buzzwords. Let's be specific.
There is no objectivity. Objectivity is already a lie because journalism is made by human beings and human beings have preferences. And if you run a story and if you position it prominently or big or small, that's already a judgment. So I think it is not about objectivity or neutrality. It is about plurality. It is about, in a way, fairness. And it is about curiosity on facts.
But let's be specific. Let's be specific about the landscape in the United States, which you are now entering in a big way. And is the New York Times, which is probably the most well-regarded newspaper in the country, along with, say, the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, are these partisan or nonpartisan news outlets, in your view?
They are nonpartisan news outlets because the diversity and quality of journalism that they deliver cannot be positioned as a kind of political agenda. There are developments where I take a more critical view, and that is if the head of the editorial pages has to resign because he published that guest commentary of a Republican senator while he was not criticized of publishing guest commentaries by Putin or terrorists. So that, I think, is problematic. And the debate about freedom of expression is needed. But to portray brands like that as kind of partisan, I think, is too superficial.
Now, Axel Springer, which owns Politico and much else, Axel Springer employees in Germany have to sign a pledge committing to, quote, principles that include a disavowal of racism, sexism, and political or religious extremism. And they've also got to support a united Europe, Israeli statehood, and a free market economy. Those are points of view. Why would Axel Springer want its reporters or editors anywhere to sign a pledge saying that they are not Brexiteers, as opposed to people who support a united Europe, or somebody who's arguing about the politics of Israel?
I think it is a very important element of transparency and honesty of a media company. We had that discussion briefly. There is no neutral journalism, and every publisher who pretends to be neutral is already lying. That's why we thought, and if I say we, it is the founder of the company decades ago who started with four principles. Then I edited a fifth principle, which is the solidarity within the free values of the Transatlantic Alliance. And we have modernized these five principles a couple of times. It is almost like a constitution of the company. Those are our fundamental social values. And that has nothing to do with party politics, with people politics, or with day-to-day politics. So there is almost endless room within these values to, on a daily basis, on a very individual basis, take positions, which our journalists do, but they do it based on that plurality of opinions. And I think it is very important to have, on the one hand, that transparency of these five constitutional values of Axel Springer. Everybody knows what we stand for. And I take pride that in our company, not everybody writes what I think is right. And I encourage this kind of dialogue and debate.
So what's confusing to me here on the pledge, for example, let's say I'm a Politico reporter and I have doubts about a united Europe. Let's say I was born in Britain and I think, in fact, the united Europe didn't work for Britain and I'm pro-Brexit, but I'm also committed to, I disavow racism, sexism, and all the rest. So if I have one part of the pledge that I don't feel comfortable with, I can't be a reporter at Politico?
Well, for example, if you would deny the principle of the free market economy and would advocate socialism as the right model for our society, then I think there are better places to work
so
for.
If I like
or
AOC,
if you say if anti-Semitism like, should be spread on social media, that's the wrong company.
Those are different things.
But Brexit, let's go concretely into the details. I personally have given an interview to the Financial Times the day after Brexit and said I'm more worried about continental Europe and the EU than I'm worried about England. I think they were just running away from too much bureaucracy and a failed policy. So that criticism is happening every day. And one person is pro-Brexit, the other one against it. That, I think, does not in general mean that you are against the idea of a united Europe. Perhaps the EU institutions failed, and that's why that event was healthy.
Now, the Washington Post reported weeks before the U.S. presidential election that you sent a surprising message to your closest executives. You wrote, "Do we all want to get together for an hour in the morning of November 3rd and pray that Donald Trump will again become president of the United States of America?" Can you clarify were you kidding around? Were you dead serious?
Yeah. Everybody who met me once or spoke to me for a couple of minutes know that was a joke. It was under the impression of that breaking news that the administration of Trump is suing Google because of abuse of market domination. And that is a topic that I was very involved with. And that was this kind of moment where basically every publisher around the world was happy about that decision. And in that context, I made that jokes to three executive colleagues in the chat. Everybody who wants to portray me as a Trumpist should read the text that I wrote for many years. In 2017, I wrote an article where I described his language as the language of the mafia. So I think I'm not in that thing, in that camp. But
if you don't mind, you also went on to argue that Trump has made the right moves on five of what you deem as the six most important issues of the last half century. Quote, defending the free democracies against Russia and China, pushing NATO allies up their contributions, tax reform, and Middle East peace efforts, as well as challenging tech monopolies. So I'm just asking to be clear, because the press coverage of does, as you say, at times make you out to be, if not a Trumpist, then certainly Trump adjacent.
I try to explain. When he took office, there was a very strong media bias in Europe and in America. And I think that has strengthened Trump even, because he became a hero, anti-establishment media. And that led also to some misunderstandings, because sometimes the wrong people can promote the right things. And in the case of Trump, very clearly, the example of China, intuitively and conceptually, that was absolutely the right direction of politics, which is, by the way, continued to a surprising degree by the Biden administration. And I think it is really important to see the topic and not the person. Another example is NATO, the push for adequate NATO funding. And it turned out to be so right after the experience of the Ukrainian war. So I think we have to distinguish general directions of policy and person. And then that leads us to the storm on the Capitol, and the denial of election results happened. And I think that is a moment where political discussions stop. That was a coup from the top. It was undermining democracy. It is perhaps the most severe threat to democracy in the recent U.S. history. And I think there should be zero tolerance. And I think party political discussions stop here.
Last year, you ordered the Israeli flag to be flown in solidarity at company headquarters during unrest in Gaza. And I don't know what you were reacting to, the anti-Semitic outbursts at demonstrations, or you were taking a side vis-a-vis the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Absolutely not the latter. But the first. And it was a moment when on Berlin streets and all over Germany, mm-hmm. a lot of anti-Semitic demonstrations happened. And in that moment, we have four flags in front of our company, and very often the LGBT flag, or we have now at the moment the Ukrainian flag. And in that moment, when there were these anti-Semitic demonstrations, we said for 1 week, we flag the Israeli flag. as a gesture of opposition against this form of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism and anti-Israelism. Some people were criticizing that and said, well, I don't want to work for a company that is raising the Israeli flag. And then I said spontaneously, and I would repeat that whenever I'm asked again, if somebody really has an issue in such a situation, then perhaps there's a better place for you to work for. Because if there is no sensitivity that particularly in Germany, in Berlin, where the Holocaust was planned and executed and where 6 million Jews were killed, the German guilt is still present. If there is not a kind of healthy reaction against it, and if you then set that gesture and people have an issue with that, then really perhaps there are better companies to work for. But I think, again, here also it's transparency, and that does not mean that we advocate a one-state solution or anything, and there, and we would also demonstrate for Palestinian rights of existence. We are for all rights of existence of legitimate institutions and nations.
So Axel Springer supports the rise of a Palestinian statehood?
I personally prefer a two-state solution, but my personal preferences don't matter. I've always distinguished that very clearly. I speak up. I'm a journalist. I worked for 20 years as a journalist. I'm occasionally writing editorials, but that has zero impact on the very diverse editorial lines of our brands. No journalist ever cares what I think.
I wonder how you see various media barons in our country. How do you see Rupert Murdoch? Is he a role model or is he a cautionary tale as far as his contributions to political discourse?
I know him, and I think what he has done over the decades is a legendary achievement. Nevertheless, I would say I'm pretty much the anti-Murdoch in my kind of self-definition. I think this whole idea of moguls and media barons is so outdated. I mean, maybe there was a time for that, but I think these times are over. So I'm a journalist who is running a media company in the role of a CEO and shareholder. I'm not a mogul. I don't want to become one. And I think for me, the most important thing is to really empower journalists in their independence and in their intrinsic anti-authoritarian instincts. You have to decide whether you either employ journalists who obey or if you employ journalists who excel. And if they obey, they cannot excel. And so you have to create a culture that they don't care what you think politically or ideologically. And also in that sense, I think a more pragmatic approach and a more forward-looking approach, a more progressive approach is our mindset.
Is Fox News a positive contribution to the discourse in American democracy?
I would put it this way. If Fox News is part of a diverse field of competition and perhaps also diverse worldviews, then it may be a contribution. I don't want to judge, but our idea is different.
What's wrong with judging it?
It can be easily perceived as one competitor tells others what they should do or what they do well or not so well. I think I'm not a friend of that, honestly. Let's talk about our own ideas and strategies, and that perhaps then indirectly also gives answers to how we see what the competitors are doing. On a more general basis, I truly think that this polarization of media landscape, and that is not only a U.S. phenomenon, the same happens in Europe. I think it's really unhealthy, not only unhealthy for the society, but also unhealthy for media brands. And of course, social media have contributed to that. The business model is based on that. The highest click rates are generated by the most polarizing and extreme headlines and words. And I think that is a tremendous opportunity for real media brands to do differently. That's the opportunity for journalism, actually.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
With pleasure.
Matthias Döpfner is the CEO of Axel Springer. And the company acquired Politico for $1 billion last year. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour with more to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Earlier this year, we published a story about protactile, an emerging language based on touch that's increasingly used by deafblind people. It was written by Andrew Leland, and one of Andrew's subjects was a man named John Lee Clark. Clark was born deaf, and he lost his sight when he was young to a condition called Usher syndrome. He became a poet and a scholar of literature, and a new collection of Clark's work is out this week. It's called How to Communicate. Andrew Leland was eager to speak with him again.
I first encountered John Lee Clark on an email listserv. Poetry Magazine was about to publish an essay he'd written, and I wrote to him asking for a copy. It was a casual request which began what was, for me, a life-changing correspondence. I have a related disease to Clark's. It's called RP, and it's causing me to slowly lose my sight. In Clark's writing, and in our correspondence, I was struck again and again by the way he described his experience as a deafblind person. Despite the rest of the world's tendency to imagine deafblind life in tragic terms, as a land of silence and darkness, Clark's writing is full of humor and life. A running theme in his work is the importance of touch, a sense that sighted and hearing people tend to diminish or ignore. Let me give you an example, a poem of his called Clamor. It's being read here by Hallene, or Hal Anderson, a woman who frequently works with John as an interpreter.
Clamor. All things, living and dead, cry out to me when I touch them. The dog, gasping for air, is drowning in ecstasy, its neck shouting, dig in, slam me. Slam me, demands one door, while another asks to remain open. My wife again asks me, how did I know, just where and how to caress her? I can be too eager to listen. The scar here on my thumb is a gift from a cracked bowl that begged to be broken.
To read and write, John usually uses a digital braille display, which converts the text on his computer into refreshable dots of braille on a little electronic device the size of a computer keyboard. As we corresponded, I began to imagine him in his home office in Minnesota, his cat asleep on his feet, playing that braille display like a virtuoso, firing off manifestos and poems and essays at all hours.
Great. Yeah. Okay.
We met up earlier this fall when he was visiting St. Louis.
Fantastic.
Great. Well, John, I'm so glad to see you again, to touch you again, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me again.
Yeah, absolutely, Andrew. This is great. It's great to be here with you.
That's Hal Anderson again. She's interpreting for John here using a language called protactile. Unlike American Sign Language, or ASL, which is a visual language, protactile happens entirely on the body. Think of rapid-fire taps, squeezes, traces, hand shapes, and presses that are all articulated on the hands, arms, shoulders, upper chest, lower thighs, and even the back. My hand that's on your knee is giving you feedback. So sometimes when you say something that, as frequently happens, rocks my world, blows my mind, I vigorously agree with, I will pat your knee like this. If you start saying something that I'm gravely disappointed with or disagree with vehemently, then I'm going to swipe and wipe, because that's the basic protactile that I know. And then if you crack me up, I do a spidery little tickle kind of on your knee.
Yes, absolutely.
Great. Clark's first language, when he still had his sight as a child, was ASL. It's what his family spoke at home. And we started our conversation talking about that early part of his life.
The first day that I attended school, I went on the bus. And I got on the bus, boarded it, sat down, we took off. My mom didn't trust that I was gonna actually like get there and be okay. And so she pulled up kind of behind the bus, she followed along the bus in her car and watched me. And when I got off the bus, she approached me and says, so how was it? Were you okay? And I said, I'm fine, but the bus driver seems to forget all how to talk, you know, all of their vocabulary. They couldn't talk with me. And she said, no, they're hearing. And I said, They're hearing? Well, what is that? So my mom had to explain to me that not everyone in the world spoke like we did. So there learning that there are other people in the world who essentially couldn't talk, that was a rude awakening.
Mm. I love that kind of inversion of how hearing people tend to frame deaf people. And it reminds us that the life of ASL is equal to that of English. And there's no reason why we need to center English in the way that the hearing world does.
Yes, absolutely. Yep, spot on, Andrew.
Yet, here you are with this magisterial book of poetry in magisterial English. So something happened along the way where you befriended English. And when and how did that happen?
Okay. Well, it's complicated. It's a little complicated. So being a baby, I immediately was immersed in the language of my family. And because I came from a deaf family, other kids knew that I was a source of information to them. You know, they didn't have a whole lot of other deaf role models in their lives. And so I ended up kind of being that for some kids. I took a leadership role as a child among my peers. And as I became more and more blind, as I got older, like, for example, in the sixth grade, I went to a school for the deaf as opposed to that little deaf program. And at that residential school, the school for the deaf, I had to abide by deaf customs, you know, and norms. And so I wound up at a crossroads because I wasn't deaf. I was deafblind. At that age, even, I was deafblind. And so I didn't fit the mold. I did not fit the deaf mold. And so, for example, I'll just give you an example here. Waving hands to get someone's attention is something that happens oftentimes. I wouldn't see someone who waved at me, and I would just go about my business, and they would think that I was being extremely rude because I wasn't responding appropriately. So people started to disregard me, to push me away. And so I was more isolated at that point, and so I got involved in books. I was like, well, if you guys are going to go on without me, well, then I've got better things to do than to go off with you, too. And I was hooked on books at that point, because of what they are infected, I guess, with readerly disease, I guess you could call it. Yeah. Because books did a whole lot for me. They helped me to get through a really tough time.
Any titles or authors come to mind as primary vehicles for that literary disease that you contracted in sixth grade?
Well, funny you ask. What happened was I entered a drugstore, and they had some mass market books on the shelf. And I had to decide, I'm going to get a book. Okay, what book should I get? So I browsed for a little minute and, of course, happened upon a super thick book. All these other slim volumes, those aren't for me. I need to go after the biggest book I could find, you know? And it happened to be Ken Follett's The Pillars of the Earth. And I ended up going back to that drugstore to buy other books. Again, those mass market books that they sell. But I noticed, though, in reading them, that it was hard to read them because their print was so small. So I was trying to figure out, well, how can I get a hold of books with bigger print? And I went to the Goodwill. And they had lots of hardcover books. And so I graduated to those because they had larger print. And then after that, ended up going into frequenting used bookstores. And then Barnes & Noble, I'd go through the bins to see which books had the largest font, you know, that was large enough for me to read comfortably. So I didn't choose books based on the story, the content, the topic. If I could read them, If they were legible to me, you know, or visible, I guess, the font size was comfortable, then they passed muster. And it actually helped me. It did take me on a sort of certain trajectory, you know, in literature. I mean, Kafka, Nabokov, you know, those kinds of authors that it just happened to be that their books were printed with larger print. If I wasn't blind, I would probably have just stuck with the mass market media, and maybe I wouldn't have moved out of that genre altogether. So hidden blessings, Andrew. Mm.
I love that. You talked about this moment when you're realizing that your vision is changing, and it's changing the decisions you make and how you live. And I want to read a poem that I think connects to that experience, which, by the way, you know, is in a very different way, I guess, something that I'm going through myself. You know, so I identify a lot with what you're saying, too, just in terms of being blind. And yet also, you know, I'm about to read this poem off the page, and that's not a oxymoron, I guess.
Absolutely.
Okay. Goldilocks in denial. Goldilocks was in deep denial and refused to use a white cane. That's how she got lost in the woods, stumbling over tree roots and things. Then she hit a wall, a house, door. She entered and wrinkled her nose and remembered the Annie movie from when she was little. It was the part where Daddy Warbucks said, "I smell a wet dog." It was dark inside, so she did her ginger duck walk and zombie arms until she came against a table with some food on it. After emptying a bag of Doritos, she wandered deeper into the house. Kitchen, bathroom, living room, small chair, too small, medium-sized chair, too hard, big recliner, ah, that's much better. When the three bears got home, they were happy to find that they had company. Papa Bear shook Goldilocks awake and asked, "Who you?" When she didn't answer, Papa Bear put his paw under her hand. She snatched her hand back and said, "I can see." Papa Bear said, "Okay," and asked again, "Who you?" She said, "I'm from Long Island, here vacation." Papa Bear asked, "When arrive here, you?" She said, "My name Yellow Curls." Papa Bear asked, "Need help, you?" She said, "We'll soon graduate, May." Papa Bear gave up and turned to Mama Bear and said, "Denial, obvious, misunderstand, misunderstand." Mama Bear said, "Sad, yes, nothing can do, leave alone." Baby Bear asked if he could play with Yellow Curls. Mama Bear thought about it and said, "No, better not. Yellow Curls' denial means hard talk, can't play good." So the whole bear clan went about their business as if Goldilocks wasn't sitting there. She jumped up and stamped her feet and said, "Not nice, you ignore, avoid me." She whirled around to make a dramatic exit, but ended up in the bedroom where she stumbled and fell into a bed. She stayed on the bed for a long time, pretending that she had planned to sleep there all along.
Nice. It shows a little bit of denial as a psychological state, right? But what happens later on, if a person's losing their vision or whatever, they sometimes things are overlooked, right? And when accidents do happen, people sometimes will say, "Oh, well, I intended to do that." So it's a psychological effect that happens that I went through myself. I noticed myself doing it. And a person usually does that when they're not in a great place. But it's a part of the journey, I would say. You know, it's part of the journey.
There's that moment in the poem when Papa Bear puts his paw underneath her hand in the way that, you know, your hand, the Hal's hand is underneath yours right now. And to me, just because I've spent time with you and have been experienced a protactile, it's clear to me as a somewhat initiated reader that that's a moment of saying, let's communicate tactilely. And part of her denial is to say, no, I can see, I don't need to communicate tactilely. And can you talk about that aspect of becoming deafblind and the way it changes how you communicate?
Mm-hmm. So as I said, in that period of time where I maybe was in denial and things were getting muddled for me, and I probably did respond as Goldilocks did, off the mark, when people mentioned or said just certain things to me, certain comments, I didn't respond, you know, in kind. But I then became a role model for other deaf people. I'm a teacher, I provide training, I get other deaf people, deafblind people on board. And when I do that, there are other people who are in that denial phase. And that's tough for me as a teacher. And I think part of that frustration that I have with them potentially is my own frustration at myself, my past self, coming up and revisiting.
I want to read another poem.
Yeah.
And this one makes me laugh every time I read it, in part because as a journalist who is writing about deafblind communities, I feel like it's a little bit of a warning sign. It's from Three Squared Cinquains. It's one of the Cinquains. The reporter is in awe. The reporter is in awe of a deafblind man who cooks without burning himself. Helen Keller is to blame. Can't I pick my nose without it being a miracle?
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, I laugh because I'm a reporter and I'm in awe, and yet I want to know how to be impressed with you, John, and your accomplishments. Well, you're strangling me now.
You should not be in awe.
But I am. And I wonder, it raises, I think, a tricky and interesting and important question about disability, which is that on the one hand, like, you're doing incredible things. Like, you've written an incredible book of poetry. On the other hand, there is such a risk of becoming that reporter who's in awe. And I wonder, like, how do we avoid that infantilizing, you know, praising you for picking your nose while still recognizing the wonderful stuff you're doing?
Well, I don't know what to advise, but I think for me, I'm a little lucky. You know, one concept maybe, one place of struggle is when lots of people with disabilities are crying, screaming for access. You know, I want access. I want access. We have these rights. We want our rights to be protected. And I think that attitude might lend itself to certain other attitudes in response. And for me, I think I take things a little bit different. My take is a little bit different. I think it can actually be a boon. It can be a benefit when we have less access to the mainstream, because it means they have less access to us. And what that means is we then have at our disposal this beautiful community. I mean, a community that isn't being thrust upon by outside forces. We have, a whole wealth of things that we can then develop, and that we can, and we don't have to be stuck with just one world. Within, we can journey into and create all kinds of different approaches and things, because we don't have anyone else sort of breathing down our necks, expecting certain things, wanting certain things.
Let me read another one of these Cinquains just to add it to the conversation.
Okay, go for it.
I think it's a riff on Emily Dickinson. Am I a nobody too?
Yes, you got it.
I had some help from my wife, but am I a nobody too? I am sorry to disappoint, but I am. Yet nobody would let me be one. Not even when I catch a bus stinking of nobodies.
Well, maybe. If some readers buy my book, they'll know I'm a deafblind poet at time of purchase. They're in awe just holding it in their hands. They haven't read a single poem, maybe. So they're just in awe, even finding out the piece of information of me being deaf. Like, wait, a deaf blind person got a book of poetry published a book of poetry? No way. The awe is there already. So I hope in those instances, in those cases, I hope that when they open that first cover, I hope that what strikes them first and foremost is a sense of disappointment. I want them to be disappointed. And then I want them to go, oh, this isn't what I thought. This isn't what I thought. And then I hope that they return to the text for the right reasons, Andrew. Mm. I have to tell you, I'm sorry, that I am selfish. I'm a selfish person. I hope that people are in awe because the poetry they read strikes awe in them. And that they are amazed by the quality of the poems that's in the book. That's my hope, my selfish hope, Andrew.
Mm. Yeah. So when we were setting up this interview, you made a joke over email about this tendency where people don't believe that the interpreter is really interpreting what the deafblind person is saying. And when I heard that, I felt really sad, but I also thought, really, you know, that's not going to be something that we're going to deal with today. And then I was talking to a friend who's very bright and really should know better. And he kind of was like, how do you know that's what, you know, that protactile is really a language and that it's not just the interpreter, you know, speaking for John or for the deafblind person. And my heart broke a little bit. What do you say to that person, you know, to the people out there who may be well-meaning, you know, but still find themselves in awe and even in disbelief of the idea that that protactile has the richness that it does?
I'm not too worried about saying anything to them, to be honest, because I do trust. I have faith in the listeners, Andrew. I trust that what they're imagining is wrong. I have faith that they are going to misconstrue some things and misconceive some things. But in that misconstrual and in some of those misconceptions, they're going to happen upon some things that are true. Many oppressed communities are really concerned with image and with representation, and they stress out about it, they worry, they take pulse, and you know, they say, oh, how are they recognizing us, and are they really sort of seeing us for who we are, and how are we being portrayed? And there's a lot of worry on the community's part about PR. I don't have a real connection with that feeling, because those of us in the deafblind community, the experiences that we've had have been so, so rich that honestly, I don't really care. And I don't mean that in a rude way. I don't mean like, I don't care about these people. No. You know, I have friends that are hearing and sighted and I adore them, I love them. That's not my point. But my point is that I'm not going to deliberate over how to convince other people to approve of me and accept the language I'm using, and I'm not going to be scanning, you know, the horizon for naysayers. I'm going to be like, when this book is published, hey, if you're into it, you know, and that's something that you're eager to delve into, do it. If it doesn't float your boat, move on. That's, you know, with a shrug. I'm too busy to worry much about what that response is in terms of what other people are thinking.
The poet John Lee Clark talking with contributor Andrew Leland. Clark's new collection, How to Communicate, is out this week. We heard the voice of Helene Anderson, who translated from spoken English into protactile. I'm David Remnick. Thanks so much for listening to the program today. I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado and Louis Mitchell. This episode was produced by Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele,
along with Adam Howard, Jeffrey Masters, Will Coley, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline, Mike Kutchman, Meher Bhatia, and James Napoli. And special thanks this week to Sarah Fenton.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.